Welcome to the Synthetic Media Podcast. I'm your host, Henrik de Cure. Join me for interviews and thoughts on the ever-expanding topic of synthetic media. You can find my book on synthetic media on Amazon. Subscribe to this podcast for free. Follow us on syntheticmediapodcast.com and enjoy today's episode.
I'm Sam Gregory. I'm the program director of a global human rights video and technology network called Witness. We work with communities of people worldwide who try and create videos you can trust on their cell phones and use them to create change in everything from situations of police violence to war crimes to pretty much any situation you can imagine where you take out a video camera or your cell phone and try and show what's real in the world. And what that means as well is that we grapple with all the technical advances that make it easier to create compelling video and all the technical and societal advances that make it harder to trust videos. So I work on what we describe as those emerging threats and opportunities to trust, authenticity, and the nature of video.
Sam, how are you involved with synthetic media?
In early 2018, I first started to talk to people who were experimenting with so-called deepfakes and synthetic media. And immediately it struck me as someone who had spent a decade dealing with what we think of as shallow fakes, like, you know, someone miscontextualizes a video and says it's from one place or from another, or stages a video, that there was a potential threat here, a threat to journalists and activists, both from what we now know as these non-consensual sexual images, but also people just trying to challenge the truth and validity of their experiences. And so we organized, I think, the first global multi-stakeholder meeting, which brought together journalists and technologists and human rights activists in mid-2018 to say, if we anticipate that the technological advances are going to continue, what do we need to do to make sure that we have a proactive discussion around what the real threats are and what the solutions are? And that meeting set an agenda for us back in 2018 of really trying to make this a global conversation about how to understand synthetic media, how to understand the possibilities, right? Like how it could help, you know, protect vulnerable people with more humanizing ways to anonymize, you know, a vulnerable interviewee, but also how it could be used to attack individuals or to undermine, you know, our societal basis of trust in videos. And so since 2018, we've run a whole series of projects of discovery and action that are all about exploring all the different ways in which synthetic media can be used maliciously, but can also be used positively. So we ran meetings that took place in Brazil, in Africa, in Myanmar, in Southeast Asia, in the US and Europe, that asked people to prioritize the threats they worried about and also the solutions they wanted. So, you know, what did people want, for example, out of solutions around detection? Or what did they want around solutions like emerging authenticity and provenance infrastructure, like the Content Authenticity Initiative? And we heard lots of things. We heard people really worried about this challenge of, the basic possibilities of citizen journalism, the realities of the liar's dividend, where people can claim anything's false, and these very strong concerns, of course, about non-consensual sexual images. And then we've taken all those issues and we've argued to researchers and platforms to structure their policies, like how Facebook treats synthetic media, to recognize that this is new and complicated, that people won't be able to spot synthesized videos as easily as they might spot, for example, you know, a miscontextualized video. And we've made a strong argument on the challenges of technology. How do you make sure that if you build a detection tool that it is available to, say, a journalist in Myanmar as well as the New York Times? And then how do you deal with the gray areas? You know, and a good example of a gray area would be something like deepfake satire, which is one of the most powerful expressive forms of deepfakes, but also one of the most complicating and potentially dangerous ones.
Sam, what are the biggest challenges and successes you've seen with synthetic media?
The biggest successes I'll start with, because I think it's important to recognize, and I come out of a video production background and Witnesses premised on, you know, a diverse and democratizing creativity of video, that, you know, some of the work in this space is really about how you broaden creativity. So, you know, lip sync dubbing as a way to translate between multiple languages, the ability to synthesize a face or a scene as a way to distribute creativity. And I've also seen experimentation that I think is very powerful for very particular use cases in my space, like the film Welcome to Chechnya, which pioneered a way for vulnerable activists in Chechnya to have their face swapped with a sympathetic solidarity activist elsewhere. And it looked like a real face, but you were protecting those individuals in a way that absolutely preserved their humanity. So I think there's creativity. I think there's ways to address old problems we've had around things like visual anonymity. I do tend to focus more on the challenges because what we heard consistently from when we did these series of global consultations, which really talked to people who had experienced similar problems like misinformation or impersonation or non-consensual sexual images. We talked to activists, we talked to people who lead countrywide movements, we talked to people who fact-checked, and they really worried about the way in which this already was challenging the basis of being able to trust images. So although most of the people we talked to actually haven't encountered misinforming deepfakes in the wild, like someone who's created a deepfake to deceive them, they have encountered someone in power who says, we're surrounded by deepfakes, or says, that's a deepfake when it isn't, it's a piece of compromising footage. So they pointed to this challenge that the existence of deepfakes, and in fact, the paranoia that media coverage has created has already created this damage, and it makes it harder and harder for, you know, already under-resourced journalists who don't have access to good tools because we don't have good detection tools, to be able to counter both the rhetorical words that people say, I just throwing out it's a deepfake, and also the increasing reality that there are deepfakes and it's getting easier to do. So we see this challenge in the world, and the technology is not really keeping pace with that, right? Like the detection technologies are not reliable and not equally available. The authenticity technologies are just starting to become available, but there are real questions whether they're going to depend on things like knowing someone's identity and whether they're going to be legislated by governments. And that may work fine in the EU and the US, but it's really problematic in someone like Myanmar or Nigeria or Brazil, where we necessarily can't trust how that will be abused. So there are big challenges ahead, which are both about the technology itself, the fear that it has already created, and the way that our solutions may actually create or contribute to bigger harms. And so we've definitely taken an approach where we say, we need to prepare, but not panic in this space. We really need to start thinking globally about how we prepare for it. And, you know, there are stories we've seen that really bring this home for us. I was involved recently in a case in Myanmar where the military coup government there released a video that appeared to show a senior politician confessing to corruption. And the population looked at it and said, look, it doesn't look like he's speaking in a normal way. His voice sounds odd. And they'd heard about deepfakes and they put it in an online deepfake detector, which said this is 95% likely a deepfake. And this news spread like wildfire. But the reality was the deepfake detection technology wasn't good. You know, deepfakes aren't quite as available as the fear of deepfakes is right out there. And, you know, one of my roles as an activist in this space was really to try and walk people back and say, unfortunately, this is probably not a deepfake. This is probably someone just forced to say something in a video. But that example for me really crystallizes this real problem we have ahead of people not being able to trust videos and being uncertain about the prevalence of deepfakes and not having the skills and the tools to really make good decisions. And this is where companies come in, as, you know, I think it's really important that startups and big companies in this space are really stepping up to say, we're going to make, you know, the products we create very detectable forensically. We're going to label the content we produce. We're going to be good actors. And then we reduce the space to the people who very purposefully choose to, you know, cross the red lines to try and deceive people, to use it to target women with these non-consensual sexual images. And that makes the problem smaller if we have better good actors in this space.
Sam, what advice would you like to share with people working on synthetic media?
So I think there's two sides to this equation. The first thing is actually for people in the broader world who are starting to engage with the possibility that there are deepfakes out there, which is this prepare, but don't panic, right? We need to actually tamp down the idea that there are deepfakes everywhere. most people are far more likely to be deceived by one of these shallow fakes. Someone just pretended an image from one place or another or changed the caption. For people who are working in synthetic media, so the people building the tools, I think there are several immediate priorities they should be thinking about. The first is they need to be part of the movement to make sure that mainstream synthetic media creation is ethical and responsible. So thinking about the consent of people in the images, is thinking about labeling, is thinking about disclosing when synthesis is used, and is really focused on policing some red lines that we can agree on in law and in human rights principles, like non-consensual sexual images. So be early, be active, don't just treat ethics as an afterthought. And then the second is, you know, to recognize that there's far more investment in technologies for creation than detection. So it's actually on the people who create tools for synthesis to make it easy for detection. So for most creative purposes, there's no reason to make it hard to detect that you use synthesis. So anyone who builds a synthesis tool should make it as detectable as possible. And then the third is, as we come to build solutions, I think there's so many well-meaning people trying to, you know, proactively solve for the potential downside of synthetic media. And I respect them and I work with them every day, but they tend to be people in the US and Europe. They tend to be men, they tend to be technologists, and they need to really listen to how their solutions could potentially have adverse consequences. So a good example is, you know, as we build these authenticity infrastructures, like the Content Authenticity Initiative or the C2PA, which are two big industry initiatives to build better ways to understand where a piece of media came from or how it was changed, you need to make sure you don't jump to ideas like, well, let's just make sure that everyone attaches an identity to this. Let's make sure that everyone has to be transparent about what they share with a video. Let's make sure that governments, you know, try and support the regulation and the incorporation of these standards. Because all of these have downsides when you look globally. If you're a citizen journalist or a community media outlet or a dissident media outlet or an under-resourced media outlet in most of the world, can you choose to use your real identity? Can you choose to be transparent? Can you risk that your government might mandate these standards? So we have to be humble with the solutions. We have to propose solutions that are opt-in, that provide signals, don't confirm that something has been manipulated. And we have to continue to listen to the potential harms and misuses that will be identified by people who are unfortunately not right in the center of the design and the innovation around synthetic media.
Sam, where can we learn more about synthetic media and your work on the subject?
So Witness has an ongoing project to really understand these dynamics around synthetic media and ensuring that the world of synthetic media is positive and attentive to a series of global and human rights concerns. We have a landing page on the Witness website that gathers together resources, videos, insights into this. If folks go to the short link is wit.to/synthetic-media-deepfakes. And each of those words in the second part are capitalized. So synthetic with a capital letter, dash media with a capital letter, dash deepfakes. You'll find on that landing page all the resources that we constantly update to help people really engage with this from an ethical human rights perspective and make the right choices as technologists, as researchers, and as a public that's increasingly coming to grips with this. The two most prominent initiatives in so-called authenticity and provenance infrastructure are the Content Authenticity Initiative that was launched by Adobe and Twitter and the New York Times, and then the C2PA, the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. And this is an area of authenticity and provenance infrastructure that Witness has worked in for a decade. It's actually an example of a space where human rights activists built these tools first, because we had to try and prove war crimes 10 years ago in places like Syria, and people would challenge the truth of our videos. So 10 years ago, Witness started building tools in this area, for example, a tool called Proof Mode with a group called The Guardian Project that added metadata that hashed the images to show they hadn't been manipulated. And we started to see about 3 or 4 years ago that this was starting to move into a more mainstream discussion, both inspired by deepfakes and concerns about them, but also by the reality of more and more of these shallow fakes and miscontextualized videos. So we've been very deeply involved in the growing industry-wide initiatives in this space. We published a report 3 years ago called Ticks or It Didn't Happen, 14 Key Dilemmas in Building Authenticity Infrastructure for Multimedia, that basically identified these 14 key questions you have to think about if you're a technology platform or a technology company trying to build solutions about tracking media provenance and manipulation. Ones like, are you going to talk about identity? Are you going to make it obligatory? Are you going to use blockchain? Are you going to think about how a government might regulate this? And that report actually meant that we became very involved in the initiatives in this space. We were one of the founding members within the Content Authenticity Initiative that helped write the white paper that has built the standards for that initiative. And I'm glad to say, seen in that initiative, that they took on board some of the concerns around, you know, making sure that identity wasn't obligatory, that it was accessible globally, that this was a system that actually thought about human rights defenders and vulnerable journalists from the beginning. And then we've also been one of the initial members in the C2PA, the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, bringing the same perspective of ensuring that right from the start, that initiative is thinking about these key values of privacy, of accessibility to someone who uses a lower end device, of also trying to think from the start about the potential harms to on a global scale. And so one of the areas we've been working on and leading within the content, the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, the C2PA, has been an analysis around harms and potential misuses. And I think it's a really important stage that every big technology initiative needs to take from the start, is to say, we're coming in with good intentions, but there are potential harms that we can mitigate, both in the way we design a technology, the way we help people implement it, and as we go forward. And so there we've really, you know, influenced the design of the specifications of C2PA, that actual standard, to really reflect some of these key concerns about identity, accessibility, making sure this is seen as an opt-in way to understand signals about a piece of media, but not a confirmation, yes, no, that this is true or false. Because we can see about how all those elements could be used against, you know, vulnerable communities, or could result in data gathering that could be vulnerable to seizure by authoritarian governments. There are three levels of kind of thinking about disclosure we should have. Mm-hmm. I think we should encourage people to have options to add the type of authenticity and provenance signals like the C2PA or CAI provide. They should be opt-in. They should have very close control from a user choosing what they want to add, because those are basically helpful signals down the line to someone to say, look, we're giving you this help to make decisions about this piece of media, to understand how it was created. So those are invisible signals, because they're obviously contained in, you know, the header of a file, in the way you can check it against, you know, something known as a validator. I think having watermarks is valuable, but you know, we know in the way people use those in misinformation, people find ways to remove watermarks. So visible watermarks are good, but vulnerable. And then the third one is really to think, and I think this is where creativity comes in. We've been leading a process around developing a kind of ethics code in this space. And one of the conversations there was really trying to understand how you could think about labeling in a way that is faithful to the different types of media traditions we have, and the way that synthesis is going to evolve, right? It's going to become more and more embedded in many creative production processes. So we're going to have to be creative. Are we going to like write it on the piece of media? Are we going to signal it in a way that is machine queryable? Are we going to try and think about how we introduce it in the credits for a piece of media? Are we going to explicitly state it with visible signals, like the people who made the Welcome to Chechnya film did, where they showed a little halo around the heads of the people who had their faces swapped to show you that they were doing it to protect people, not to deceive the audience? So I think there's actually a real potential also for creative expression in how we think about signaling that goes beyond watermarking and the types of authenticity signals that something like the CAI provides.
Join us next week for a new episode by subscribing to the Synthetic Media Podcast. Check out my book about synthetic media on Amazon. Follow us on syntheticmediapodcast.com. This podcast was produced by Henrik de Gior. Music by Mattia Capelli. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. And thank you for listening.